Hello. Thank you. Thank you. Welcome. Welcome to the Mike Lazaridis Theater of Ideas here at Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics in Waterloo, Ontario, Canada. And welcome to Perimeter's Public Lecture Series. My name is Greg Dick. I'm the Director of Educational Outreach here at Perimeter, and it is my sincere pleasure to welcome everyone here this evening, both those of you here in the live studio audience and those of you watching online, either on Perimeter's website or on one of our many science communication colleagues' websites around the globe. Now, the lecture itself will last approximately 1 hour and will be followed by a question and answer session. For those of you watching online, we have Dr. Damian Pope and a team of PI researchers behind their keyboards watching the Twitter and Facebook feeds and are willing to answer questions throughout the lecture. If you want to participate in that conversation, use hashtag PILive. And I will also take a question or two from the Twitter feed at the end. And now it is my pleasure to introduce Dr. Paul Schaefer. Dr. Schaefer completed his PhD in chemistry at McMaster University, where he focused his research on nuclear medicine imaging and therapy, specifically radiochemistry, the field of medical isotopes. Dr. Schaefer was recognized by Business in Vancouver as one of British Columbia's top 40 under 40 individuals for his ability to deliver high impact results. As the associate lab director of the Life Sciences Division of Triumph, Dr. Schaefer has led a research team that explores the use of accelerators to develop tools and techniques to advance the field of nuclear medicine. Tonight, he will share with us leading-edge developments and discuss the promise that advanced medical isotopes have for disease diagnostics and therapeutics. Please join me in welcoming to the stage Dr. Paul Schaefer with his talk, Get a Half-Life, at Isotopes as the Unlikely Hero of Modern Medicine. Dr. Paul Schaefer.
All right, thank you everyone for coming. It's been a wonderful visit so far. Very gracious guests, and my hosts have been very kind today. Wonderful visit to Waterloo, so thank you for having me. As you heard already, my name is Paul Schaefer. I'm the Associate Laboratory Director in charge of Life Sciences at Triumph. I wanted to tell you one thing about me before I get started, so that when it comes time for question and answers, that you know what you're going to be contending with. I have a hearing problem, and if you have a question, please speak up. You can speak deliberately, and I'll do my best to answer your question. And other than that, Greg has offered to offer a English-to-English translation for me in the event I don't quite get it. So please bear with me during that time. Okay, so for today's presentation, I'm going to talk to you about isotopes as they are applied to medicine. And to give you some context about where I'm coming from when giving this presentation, I wanted to explain a little bit about Triumph and that it is a national laboratory. We are owned by 19 separate universities. They are both members and associate members, so 19 total. And they range pretty much from coast to coast. And while the word Triumph, Tri standing for three universities, stood for the University of Victoria, the University of British Columbia, and Simon Fraser University, those are the three founding university partners of Triumph. The first board meeting 48 years ago, or almost 50 years ago, was immediately added to our ranks, the University of Alberta. And ever since then, we've been building and building our membership. So Triumph has been around for almost 50 years, and we have been working steadily on developing a science program that's based around accelerators. And so accelerators are things that make other things go fast. And so basically we have a particle accelerator, many of them, and based on accelerators in themselves also serve, they have their own science development aspect, but the accelerator tools at Triumph also enable a broader scientific program that includes particle and nuclear physics, which is by and large the largest research effort at Triumph. But there's also an applied component, which is nuclear medicine and material science. So my research program is centered in one quadrant there, nuclear medicine. And so from there, we draw on the expertise of many to get what we get done. So hopefully by the end of this presentation, you'll see how physics applied to medicine can lead to societal benefit. And that's what the outer ring of our program representation here on this wheel is that we want to connect Canada to the world in many aspects of accelerator science. We want to leverage our university partners and to the world and to Canada, across Canada. We want to be leaders in what we do. And we also want to derive societal benefit, economic benefit. And I am also hoping by the end of today's presentation, you see that when your tax dollars, my tax dollars, are spent on basic research, there is a good outcome and there is a real benefit for all of us. So Science Triumphs program is very broad in terms of its scope. And I like to describe it as a program that spans inner space to outer space. We have a program that starts with studying the intricate ways in which particles and subatomic particles interact with each other on the inner space side, all the way up to understanding how the cosmos is made. And from there, we have a range of different applications in between. And so today's presentation will focus more on the middle part here, where, as you can see, we have nuclear medicine and the interaction of matter with matter in order to study medicine and to enable medicine. This diagram does show one thing I wanted to talk about before moving on, and that's this representation of the atom here. Many of us may recall from high school days, university days, that the structure of the atom is largely defined in a simplified form as what you see here. In the center, we have a nucleus that's composed of two types of particles, protons, which are positively charged, and neutrons, which are neutral. Around that, in order to balance the charge of the protons, we have electrons that circulate. And they may or may not be a spherical orbit, but basically this, I just wanted to bring everyone into the mindset of where we're going today. This representation starts this talk off and where I want to go. So just remember, a nucleus, two types of particles, surrounded by electrons, and that is how we get our elements. So I wanted to take a quick poll of the audience and be interactive here. And my question to you is, who remembers this periodic table of the elements? Great, almost every hand goes up. That's fantastic. Who doesn't want to remember this? That's the other question, right? Yeah, a couple of people, right? Okay. So the periodic table of the elements, from a chemist's perspective, is the basic representation of the matter of the world around us in looking at chemicals, compounds, in their simplest form. You cannot reduce these elements beyond this in a chemical sense, so to a smaller form. So hydrogen is on the top left there. And it is comprised, its nucleus has one proton in it, and it is orbited by one electron, ideally. So that is the simplest element, hydrogen. And the second most simplest element is helium. It has two protons surrounded by, in this nucleus, two electrons are orbiting around that nucleus. And you go on and so on and so forth. Lithium, very common in our cell phone batteries, three protons. Carbon, six protons. Oxygen, eight protons, so on and so forth. So you build the universe around us by adding protons to the nucleus. The number of protons define the element, all right? And so from there, what was ingenious about this table, and I'll get into a little bit of history about this later on, is this table tries to arrange the elements according to how they behave chemically. And that's driven in part by how the electrons are arranged around the nucleus. So this class of elements on the left-hand side maintain, not identical, but similar chemistry as you go down each one of these periods, the periodic table of the elements. So you have alkaline earths, rare earths, you have organic main group, you have noble, very inert compounds, and you have transition metals in the middle. So you can see the table arranges the matter by class. And then down here you have some very exotic nuclei. But overall, the table, as I mentioned, describes the chemical behavior, or an approximation of the chemical behavior, based on the way those electrons interact with each other. And that's what defines the chemistry that happens between elements to make up the world around us. But there's another dimension here that's not shown. And that is, inside the nucleus is that other particle, the neutron. And if you can imagine, there's a thickness to each one of these squares. So rather than sequentially increasing the nuclear size by one proton each time, we also have a neutron component. And that neutron component adds mass to that nucleus. And those neutrons are what define isotopes, and isotopes of an element. So with that, I wanted to officially welcome you to the awesome world of isotopes. And my hope by the end of this presentation is that you become a fan of isotopes, and that when you're at a party and there's the fear or indifference that you encounter sometimes at a party involving science talk, that you can advocate for what you heard today and understand that isotopes can be something that are of immense benefit to all of us. So here's how we represent isotopes. So I already told you that the periodic table of the elements represents the sequential addition of protons to define each element going up. So if you have the element hydrogen, you basically end up with a Z or a Z, depending on where you're from, of one. And so the atomic number one will make this X turn into an H for hydrogen, right? And then from there, we have to decide what is the actual mass of that element. And so the mass number is defined by the number of protons plus the number of neutrons. And so in some of the representations you'll see, the Z or the Z will drop away because once you name that element, this is understood. But what isn't known is this one. And that's why you often only see a number in the top left representing the mass coupled to which element you're dealing with. So here's an example. Hydrogen is the simplest element. Would be represented with one H1, right? And because the X, or the H, is defined by one proton, you have one proton in the nucleus, and ideally you have one electron orbiting, and that makes hydrogen, or some people call it protium, but I think most people call it hydrogen. But you also have the ability to add a neutron to the nucleus, and that makes it twice as heavy. So here you have deuterium, or 2H1, and again, the one could disappear because hydrogen implies one proton, but now the two tells you there's one proton and one neutron. And then for tritium, 3H1 could be looked at as just 3H. And now you know, but because it's hydrogen, it has one proton, so the two remaining nucleons must be neutrons, right? So this is the sequential addition of neutrons to give you heavier forms of the same element, right? The fascinating thing as well is that the element on the left, hydrogen, is stable. It exists in the world around us, as does deuterium, even though it's less common. But tritium is radioactive. It falls apart. And so as you add to the mass, or in some cases take away the mass of a neutron, you introduce instability. Okay, and that's how we're going to come to understand isotopes very soon here. So we also have the same situation for more complex atoms. So here's carbon. Carbon is defined by having six protons in the nucleus. You can see six is on the left, six is in the center, and six is on the right. But you can also have carbon-12, which is what largely you and I are made of when we have carbon in us. There's carbon-13, which is less prevalent but also stable. And then you have carbon-14, and I think most people have heard of radioactive carbon dating, and that's the isotope they're looking at in this particular case. So the difference is 6 neutrons, 7 neutrons, 8 neutrons, okay? So same principle, but now a heavier nucleus. So if I take the entire periodic table of the elements now, and I spread it out and plot the number of, plot an isotope by the number of neutrons versus the number of protons in the nucleus, this is what I get, okay? Now I haven't had dinner yet. This roughly resembles a pork tenderloin to me, but so just remember when I refer to pork or pork tenderloin, I'm talking about the chart of the nuclei. And what this is showing us is a remarkable thing, and that is the black line that runs up the middle. This is a magnification of the bottom left-hand corner of what this chart is showing here. And the black line represents those stable nuclei that I just described before. And I told you that protium or hydrogen and deuterium were stable. So you can see in this chart that those two are black and represented here. Tritium is unstable. You notice the color changes. And there are actually more isotopes of tritium as you move to the right because the number of neutrons is increasing. But you'll see that once I change it from one proton to two protons, you're now dealing with isotopes of helium. Okay, and so this sequentially builds up, and you build up many thousands of different nuclei that are comprising of that comprise the universe around us. And you can see that there are several elements that have multiple stable, but many unstable isotopes. And it's the fascinating fact that most of the universe is actually made of effectively unstable nuclei that are known, but they all settle down into this valley of stability in the middle. So what is radiation, and what does it mean to be radioactive? So radiation, by definition, is essentially the movement of energy through space. And from an isotope chemist perspective, radiation comes in two forms. It's particulate or it's electromagnetic. And a particulate radioactive substance, basically the emission of a particulate entity, has a mass, and it usually has a charge. Sometimes it doesn't because of a neutron. But the mass movement through space has a velocity that is proportional to the energy that it was given when the decay event happened. And there are a number of different examples I'll get to on the next slide that we have called affectionately alpha, beta. There are proton-only and neutron-only decays, but these are examples of particulate-type emissions. Electromagnetic, on the other hand, has no mass or charge, and they propagate as distinct packets of energy. And I think most of us may be familiar that the package of energy comes in the form of a photon. And so the pictorial representation on the right here shows that a radioactive atom can decay by a quantum, or a wavelength of light, or by a particulate emission. And so keeping in mind those two basic overarching types of radioactive decay, I wanted to explain very briefly that there are rules by which atoms fall apart when they are unstable. And we have fission, atoms that like to undergo fission, which is a heavy nucleus that splits into multiple fragments, two fragments plus a couple of neutrons, and we'll talk more about that in a bit. There's something called isomeric transition, which is basically a relaxation of a nucleus from an energetic configuration into a ground state configuration. And so this is one isotope I'd like you to remember, technetium. We'll be talking more about that one. And the M beside technetium-99, M, means metastable. And the relaxation of that nuclei to 99G just means that it's dropping in energy and it's not changing element type. But that energy change results in some sort of photon emission. And then from there you also have alpha decay, which an alpha particle is essentially the equivalent of a helium nucleus that's being shot out of the nucleus itself. And then there's two types of beta decay, beta minus and beta plus. And beta plus is a positron or an anti-electron, beta minus is an electron. So I think of Star Trek, matter, antimatter. And that's there's rules there that basically define what type of emission is going to happen based on where the neutron to proton ratio is for that nuclei. And then there's things like electron capture, where it's much more favorable for an electron to fall into the nucleus and effectively convert a proton into a neutron, resulting in energy release as well. So this isn't an exhaustive list, but it shows you that there are rules. And these rules largely come together to in an understood way. And there's the next two slides that I wanted to basically portray just how those rules play out. So you remember our pork tenderloin, and we have here the chart of the nuclei that go up, and you'll notice that for the proton versus neutron ratio, which is the black line, it's a straight line that runs up there. The chart of the nuclei starts to deviate towards the neutron side, and that's because of the need to alleviate some of that positive charge that builds up as more and more protons build up in the nucleus. But as you deviate, that line of stability follows that those black dots that you see. So this is the line of stability that defines the stable elements in the universe. But you also see, based on the graph above, that as you deviate from that line of stability, there's also a consequence in how unstable you get as you get further and further away. So something that's further away is largely blue in color, or light blue, and you can see that the half-lives are extremely short, on the billionth of a second type scale. Whereas in the middle, you have stability, and those are isotopes that have half-lives on the order of petayears, 10 to the 15 years decay time. So there's quite a range across there, and you can see there's coloring between there, and it's those little pockets of color, the reds and the greens and the yellows, where medical applications start to play, and then we'll start talking about some of the exciting isotopes that are being used there shortly. Okay, so one last point about the chart of nuclei before I move on, and that is if you overlay the decay behavior that is typical for an isotope on that chart of nuclides, I think you'll notice a trend here. And that is that On this side is yellow, which means electron capture or positron decay typically occurs. On this side is green, which means that there's beta minus decay. And up here you'll see the reds, and then up here it's maybe a little bit difficult to see. You'll start seeing the spontaneous fissions and whatnot up in the heavier realm here. But if you think about it, this makes perfect sense, and that's because the electron capture and beta, okay, if you look at the chart of nuclides and what it's trying to tell you, it's trying to help us predict what's going to happen when there's a nuclear reaction occurring. So you have the original nuclide in a box, and from there, I was just describing the positron product, or the electron capture decay product. So you're talking about a drop in that chart from one square into one that is down and to the right. If you think about that positron product, what you're doing is you're trying to get towards that line of stability. And then if you're looking at a beta product, which goes this way, you're trying to get towards that line of stability. And it's the same thing for alpha. You're going a helium nuclei, two neutrons, two protons out, you're ending up down here. Those alpha decays are trying to get to that line of stability. Okay, so that's basically what's happening there. And so now you're up to speed, and hopefully on the same page as I am, when it comes to the isotope universe around us and the chart of nuclides and what it's trying to tell us. And so from there, I wanted to start describing how we actually make and study isotopes. So there's really two ways. Some people say there's three. I say there's two, but I'll explain that in a minute. There's two ways of making isotopes. I guess I never thought of this. There's the third way would be by nature itself, right? But nuclear reactors are one way of making unstable nuclei. And this is something that Triumph's more familiar with, and that is the use of particle accelerators. And for the purpose of this presentation, an accelerator is hereby called a cyclotron. Okay, and that's quite simply because it's an accelerator that accelerates particles in a circle. And we do that by implementing a very strong magnetic field coupled to a radio frequency acceleration component. So between electricity and magnets, we effectively accelerate particles and create isotopes from that. So making isotopes can occur in either situation. And in a reactor, this is typically what you see. Reactors typically use uranium for fuel. And the core would look like that. I used to work at McMaster University. They had a light water reactor where you could stand on a bridge above the core, and you could see that lovely blue glow coming from the core when it was critical. And reactor is doing is fission of the fuel. And you'll see the probability on this graph on the right-hand side that basically shows you the yield of a product from the splitting of uranium-235, which is the start of the process. And you can imagine that it kind of makes sense that you see this double hump, because if you take the mass of one of these elements and you add it to the corresponding fragment that forms with the fission, you're going to get a total mass that, along with plus or minus a few neutrons and whatnot, you'll get uranium-235. So this is the probability of forming those isotopes. There's a reason why I pointed out molybdenum-99. One is to say the word molybdenum-99, and then from here on forward tell you that I'm going to call it moly-99, because molybdenum is really hard to say over and over and over again. But moly-99 is the parent. In other words, it decays to technetium-99m, and that's the isotope we're going to talk about later. Okay, so this is what happens in a reactor. And it is from this soup of mixture of isotopes that we extract the isotopes we're interested in. So they have to be long-lived enough, and they have to be chemically unique enough to pull them out. From a cyclotron, though, what we're doing is, as I mentioned, accelerating protons or particles. They're not always protons, but in our case, they usually are. And you bombard targets that contain a stable material. And so in this case, I'm giving an illustration where we're irradiating a target on a machine. A cyclotron looks like the one you see on the left. You saw a different version a couple slides ago. This cyclotron is located in a hospital basement in Vancouver at the BC Cancer Agency. And inside the blue box on the left there with the tag or the bottle hanging off the side right here is a target that is a cylinder that contains nitrogen gas. And the nitrogen that we in the air that we breathe around us is nitrogen-14. And that nitrogen gas encounters the proton and absorbs the proton when there's the right energy and so on and so forth. I'll explain that in a minute. It momentarily forms oxygen 15 per se, and then it falls apart. And it falls apart according to a number of different channels here. There are different options, and there's a probability for each one. And in many cases, there is one that's favored, and it's one that we've come to use routinely. So you have the possibility of forming exotic isotopes of oxygen. You can form radioactive isotopes of carbon, carbon-11 in this case, or other nitrogen isotopes as well. And so from there, basically, we have come to understand that carbon-11 is the most common product in this particular case. So we use nitrogen-14 gas to make carbon-11. And carbon-11 is a wonderful isotope because it is chemically equivalent to carbon-12, and we can create drugs, radioactive drugs, that exactly chemically mimic the carbon-12 derivative, except this has a 20-minute half-life, so we have to work very, very quickly in order to use those drugs. Okay, so what happens then, to illustrate, is you have a nitrogen-14 target, your proton is accelerated, comes out of that cyclotron, you have your decay, instant transformation, if you will, I wouldn't call it decay just yet, into the products, and in this case, carbon-11 is the most common product. Okay, and there's the summary of what I just told you. So, reactors, fission, cyclotrons, bombardment, and together they can create artificial isotopes. And the rules that govern how quickly we have to work with those isotopes are shown here. The amount of activity that we produce, or have, I should say, in our possession, is quite simply equal to the number of nuclei that are radioactive in relation to a term that we've called lambda here. And lambda is a representation of the natural log of the number 2 over the half-life of that radioisotope. And when you plot that, this is the type of curve that you get. So when you start at time 0 and you have 10 units of radioactivity, you have a half-life of 10 minutes. After 5 minutes, you're going to have half that much. But it's important to know that after 10 minutes, you're not going to have nothing. You're going to have a quarter, right? And then it just drops by half each time. So this is the one, law of decay that you have to deal with when producing isotopes. It's gonna fall apart on you by nature. But as you're producing isotopes, this is what happens. When you bombard a target, you have a relationship, which I've broken down here, which basically describes the key parameters of that machine, that cyclotron, that you need to consider when you're making isotopes. So the amount of activity you're going to make this time, instead of what you have on the last slide, is going to depend on the intensity of that machine bombarding. How many protons is it spitting out into your target? The amount of energy that beam has, and the probability of that, in that energy range, it gets absorbed by your target. And then the amount of time that you're irradiating the target for. On the target end, you have two key parameters, and that is how much material are you irradiating, and how pure is it isotopically. So if you have a mixture in there, you get a mixture of products. And so all of this is represented in this equation, and I think if you plot this, what you're going to see is that you produce over a period of time, and that's again defined by the half-life. But after a certain amount of time, that decay component you saw in the previous slide is going to start to catch up to you. And eventually you're going to reach a point where you can no longer bombard and make more. It's going to be in equilibrium. And so we have to weigh, as cyclotron operators and isotope providers, how many half-lives we want to irradiate for. And for all intent and purpose, practically, we want to sit between one and two half-lives, typically, because you're going to make between 50 and 75% of your theoretical maximum. And as you continue to go up, you can see your derived benefit gets smaller and smaller. So first, an isotope like carbon-11 will irradiate that target for 20 minutes. Has a 20-minute half-life. For something like fluorine-18, it has a 2-hour half-life. We could irradiate that target for 2 hours, and we'll be halfway up that saturation curve. And for technetium, which I'm going to talk about later, one half-life is 6 hours. And so you can see now, not only are you running into a lack of benefit, you're starting to run into a real problem with the amount of hours you have in a day. We'll get to that in a minute. So from here, this is really a brief description of that third isotope production method. You have that reactor, you have cyclotrons, but some people consider generators to be sources of isotopes, but I don't consider them to be that because, quite honestly, we get the parent isotope from a reactor or a cyclotron. And what we do is we package that parent into a vessel that looks like this. These are about the size of a coffee canister, a coffee thermos, and they weigh a lot more. And they all have a similar design. You can see that there is an inlet and an outlet on each one. And so what people have done over the years is they've devised a way to chemically embed a parent isotope. So let's take the one on the left, germanium-68, is embedded onto a material on the inside. And when you pass a solution through the inlet and it comes out of the outlet, you manage to extract the daughter, gallium-68. The same holds true for strontium-82 or rubidium-82 as the daughter, or molybdenum-99, that one that I asked you to remember from the reactor, and the daughter being technetium-99m. And the numbers below that show you the half-life of those isotopes. You have germanium with a very long half-life, almost a year, decaying to a very short-lived daughter, 68 minutes. You have a very, very short-lived daughter here at 1.3 minutes, or 6 hours for technetium. But all in all, the principle is the same. These generators are delivered to a hospital. They're allowed to sit around, and you extract an isotope from them on a periodic basis. So what defines that period? Well, here's how generators work. So I'm using technetium-99m here as an example. And there's another picture of another technetium generator on the top left-hand side. And on one side, you have a vial of saline. And another side, you have an evacuated vial. It has a vacuum in there that will pull the saline through a column. And on that column, it's basically filled with sand or alumina, crushed glass, if you will. Very clean, very pure. And the alumina by nature holds on to the molybdenum-99. And when it decays to the technetium-99m, the technetium is more soluble. And so as you pass the saline through that column, only the technetium is brought with it into that vial. And this is how it's done. And you'll see that there's a significance to the numbers on the bottom here, but let's describe what happens first. You have molybdenum-99 with a 66-hour half-life, so it's decaying somewhat slowly. You have technetium-99m, which has a 6-hour half-life. So if you leave that generator alone, that product will build in, and then this sharp dip represents the moment you pull the isotope out of that generator. And then if you leave it alone again, it'll build back in, and then you can pull the daughter out again. You leave it alone, you pull it out. You leave it alone, and you pull it out. And you'll see that 24 is a multiple of 6, right? And so technetium with the 6-hour half-life, this is just basically showing you that a generator will replenish itself over a few half-lives of the daughter nuclei. So it's this wonderful concept that has led to the generation of generators, so the development of generators. And those generators are delivered to hospitals, and they represent a safe and convenient way of milking those generators. And because the term milked is used, those generators are often called cows. And so the cows are in the hospitals, and you pull the isotopes out of the cows. And from there, they get injected into the patient. Okay, so now we're going to talk about the advent of the application of radiation or isotopes in medicine. And one could arguably look at the history and Röntgen's development of, or realization that he was producing a new type of penetrating ray which could see through his wife's hand. His wife was wearing her wedding ring, and you can see that as the dark blob there. And so he realized that the skeletal picture he was producing of his wife's hand was magically looking through the skin and the muscle on his wife's hand and showing only the denser material, the metal obviously being the densest and the darkest. And so while that's not an isotopic imaging method, it's arguably one of the first medical applications that would come to fruition today, and the use of x-rays for imaging inside of us. So for that work, he won the Nobel Prize in 1901. And then around the same time, Henri Becquerel was storing a sample of uranium in a drawer on top of some photographic film. And he once pulled out the film and realized that it had been exposed somehow, even though it was sitting in a dark drawer. And from that, he came to realize that there was something radiative about that ore, about that element. And he started to develop the concept of radioactivity. But he didn't fully understand what that was. He just knew something different was happening there. Where was this radiative property coming from? Well, the Curies came along not too long after and really put it all together. Marie Curie basically spent her PhD thesis refining tons of ore, uranium ore, and extracting just a small mass of radium out of that, as it's a radioactive element, from that ore. And for that work, she won the Nobel Prize along with Becquerel and her husband in 1903. I wanted to point out that not only is she a female scientist back in the day, likely unpaid, underappreciated, she won her first Nobel Prize 18 months after she got her PhD. Which really makes me wonder what I've done with my life. The second Nobel Prize that she won was for a slightly different reason, but she's won two Nobel Prizes in her career. So completely outstanding achievements by an early female scientist. So anyways, just a note for all those young female scientists thinking of taking up a career in the field. From there, it was Georges de Hevesy that really started to move things towards where we are today. And he came up with the idea of something called the tracer principle. And that was to take radioactive materials and to put it inside of something. And in his case, it was plants. And he was using a radioisotope of lead. And he could follow physiological processes inside the plant by tracking lead. And so he came up with the tracer principle. And I'll describe why it's called tracer in just a bit. Okay, today, this is what we're typically dealing with. So radio tracers are drugs. Okay, and here are chemical structures of drugs. I'm not wanting to dwell on what each one of them are, except some may be interested in knowing that we have radioactive forms of Ritalin. We have also developed radioactive forms of cocaine and other drugs. And why we can use them and not hurt people, I'll explain in 1 minute. But you have all of these different types of drugs, and you'll see that one atom in on these molecules is radioactive. Here we have fluorine 18, and the rest have carbon 11 here. There's another carbon 11 on this molecule, carbon 11 on the other one. And so what's happening is we know these drugs, and the body recognizes these drugs, to behave in a certain way. And we have a representation of a physiological process, and in this case, we're looking at a neurotransmitter, a synapse, if you will, between a nerve terminus and a nerve downstream, which propagates the signal. Now, my brain tells my hand, my arm, to move like this, and it moved. And then I want it to come back, and it came back, and that's great, right? And it's the neurotransmitter dopamine that is helping me do that. Now, when that system starts to break down, we lose control over that. And so with diseases like Parkinson's disease or other cognitive decline diseases, as many that affect the older people in our population, it's a result of a breakdown here. And the question is, where is that breakdown? And can we come to understand where the problem is so that we can fix it? So here's fluorodopa, right? And so fluorodopa is a feedstock, a substrate for an enzyme that's converting an amino acid called tyrosine into the neurotransmitter dopamine. And if the body mistakenly thinks this radioactive form of DOPA is what it wants, it will convert it into dopamine. And so where that enzyme is acting, this drug will accumulate. Then it tends to, the body will typically store that neurotransmitter in tiny bubbles or vesicles at the end of that terminus, waiting for that stimulus. And then when that stimulus comes, those vesicles merge with the cell membrane and release their neurotransmitter into the gap, into the synapse, which travel across, bind to that postsynaptic receptor, and the signal carries on, okay? But you can see it's a complex system, and we've developed over the years tools, not just at Triumph, this is in the community, tools to monitor different aspects of that system. So we have DOPA to look at the enzyme activity. We have a compound called dihydrotetrabenazine, or DTBZ for short, to look at those bubbles or those vesicles. We have a compound called raclopride to look at the postsynaptic receptors. Another drug to look at postsynaptic receptors, and a recycling mechanism called the dopamine transporter, which helps take the neurotransmitter back up into for reuse. And so we have drugs to look at all of those, and we can use these to image and understand what's happening functionally, not anatomically. And that's my main point, is you have carbon 11, which, because it's on the north side of that line of stability, it's trying to decay back to something more stable. In this case, it's boron 11. But that is anecdotal. That doesn't matter. What happens is a positron comes out of that nucleus. It combines with a nearby electron. And matter, antimatter, boom, right? You get two 511 keV photons that come out. And the significance of 511 here is if you take that famous equation, E equals mc squared, and you punch in the mass of an electron and the mass of a positron and the speed of light, c, right, square it, and you come up with energy, you'll come up with 1.02 MeV. You split that into two and you get 511 keV. So that represents the matter to energy conversion of those two particles, and that's the photon that comes out of someone. And so basically when those drugs accumulate into an area of the brain, you get a concentration map of where those drugs are acting, and that's the dark red spots, and the less active areas are blue or purple and green. And this is an example of how we can derive important information from that process. So we have the individual on the left is a normal individual. They've been injected with a drug, fluorodopa, which is taken up into those two comma-shaped areas. And that shows normal function. That shows that this person can tell their arm to move and it will move, and they can tell it to come back and it will come back. But when someone has Parkinson's disease, you can see that function is lost. And that's where we start to understand where the problem is. There's a problem with that enzyme to make dopamine. Or there could be a problem with the recycling mechanism. There could be a problem with the storage, those bubbles. So it's this information that we can use to start to understand disease before symptoms start to show. Okay, and these are the types of cameras that we use in the hospital to take those pictures. I wanted to give you one very quick and very cool example of how functional imaging can really be used. And this is one that's been done by my colleagues at the University of British Columbia. I was not involved with this study, but it was a very, very brilliant study. They took this radioactive drug, which we know binds, based on that previous slide, to that postsynaptic receptor. This person has Parkinson's disease, and they came in and they were given a drug, and they derived benefit by taking that drug. Their symptoms went away. Then the next day, they agreed to participate in a study, and the next day they came back, and having agreed to participate in the study, they were told that there was a possibility they were going to be given a placebo, and they were told there was a probability that placebo was 25% chance, 50% chance, or 75%, or 100% chance that pill was a sugar pill, a placebo. And when told that there was a 75% chance that drug was a placebo, we always gave them placebo, by the way. We lied to them. They always got a sugar pill. You can see that the image on the left shows those darker red and orange areas. And on the right, they get lighter. What that means is this drug is binding less. In other words, this person was able to make their own dopamine again all of a sudden. The dopamine that flooded into the brain when this person was told they were given a pill that was going to help them gave them a pharmaceutical effect. The symptoms stopped. So why is that? And can we harness that? Now, we can't lie to everybody indefinitely. They're going to catch on, right, eventually. But the bottom line is there's a biochemical reason for that. And can we understand more about the brain and help develop a treatment for Parkinson's disease in the future? We're not there yet, but this is the type of information that we can look at. Okay, so from there, I wanted to describe what the tracer effect is. Isn't it cute? Yeah, right. So this is the mole, and the mole has two meanings. One is the mole that used to create large dirt piles on my front lawn. The other mole is what chemists refer to as this many atoms or molecules in a mole of material. To put things into context, a mole of water is 18 grams or about 18 mils. So you can, it's just a small amount of water. But a typical radiopharmaceutical dose is only about one nanomole, right? And that means that's about 18 nanograms. That means one drop of water has enough drug or has enough water for about 1,000 people. All right, so that's a very, very small amount of material. So if you're injecting that small amount of material into someone, there's going to be no response at the pharmaceutical level. And that's why we can use these radioactive drugs to probe the system without perturbing it. This is the tracer principle, okay? And that's what they're exploiting in order to get those PET images. Okay, so there are many other isotopes that we can use, and this graph of the periodic table now represents some of those isotopes that are being used. And you can imagine that the ones with multiple colors on them represent multiple isotopes that can be used for different purposes. Okay, so there are many more coming online, and it's a very exciting and developing area. And I wanted to focus on one particular isotope. Here's Mendeleev. Mendeleev is largely credited with coming up with the modern periodic table. This was his version in the late 1800s. And you'll notice that there are some missing isotopes. You see some question marks here. So he appreciated that there was this periodicity in the universe around us, and that we were missing some. We didn't know where some of these were. One of the significant ones is this one here, number 100. No one found it yet. And in fact, after about 40 or 50 years, this is Glenn Seaborg, who is also credited with finding a lot of the many heavy elements. There are many others that contributed to this field. But that number 100, okay, you can imagine that was a mass. Now we're looking at the number of protons. Things are evolving here. It's right here. So the number 43 is still missing. And we know today that that's where technetium is. But there is no stable element or isotope, I should say, of technetium. So none existed in nature. Very little existed in nature, and people were not able to isolate it and study it. So it turns out that someone did claim to discover it, and here's my other stump for female scientists. Ida Nodak, she was one of the first women in Germany to study chemistry. Positions for PhD, women PhD employees back in that time were unpaid. She basically, in 1925, published a paper that said, I found element number 43, technetium. She called it Mazurium in honor of the region where she was born. Now, people were able to validate the fact that she found rhenium, element number 75, but they were unable to repeat her experiment for technetium, largely discredited, virtually booed off of the stage. Please don't do that to me. And so she was basically discredited, and no one really took her word for it. Later studies validated that, in fact, she was right. But in 1934, now a few years later, she stood up in front of Enrico Fermi, who won the Nobel Prize in 1938 for basically discovering more radioactive elements and is essentially the father of a fission of nuclear reactors. And she said, well, you're telling me you think you created element 93 by bombarding uranium and with neutrons. And I think it's actually conceivable that you broke that nucleus apart. And these people at this time thought there's so much energy in these nuclei that there's no possible way that we could break these elements apart. But in fact, she was right. By bombarding uranium with neutrons, he was inducing fission. And in other words, 3 or 4 years before the Americans basically came online and had discovered the fission of uranium and a sustained nuclear reaction, she, a German scientist, could have been the one that effectively, or was the one that effectively recognized neutron-induced fission. This changed the course of history. If the Germans had understood fission 4 years before the Americans, World War II broke out in 1940 and ended a few years later, and the history of the planet would have changed if only they had listened to a female scientist, right? And so again, I'm not saying that it would have been for the better, but certainly we shouldn't be so quick to discredit or discriminate. Anyways, she was nominated for the Nobel Prize 3 times, and she never won. Eventually, technetium was recognized, and it came online in the 1950s. Two gentlemen, Walter Tucker, and Paul Harber and Paul Richards basically conspired together to produce the first technetium generator. They took molybdenum-99, that parent, they embedded it on a column, and they were able to flush that daughter off with saline, right? This is how they did it back in the 1950s and 60s. No gloves, probably no safety glasses, radioactive substance, you know, everything, right? And so it's fantastic work. But it took off so quickly that by 1966, Brookhaven National Lab backed out of the generator business because commercial suppliers were jumping on board. And so today, this is where we're at. Reactors, there's a handful of reactors around the world that produce molybdenum-99 from the fission of uranium. And this isotope, technetium, has blossomed into the world's most common isotope. It's used almost 50 million times, between 30 and 50, I say 40 million here, per year. That amounts to 76,000 scans a day. We got more than a scan a second happening somewhere in the world with someone in, using technetium. 30 to 40% of that technetium comes from Canada, the National Research Universal Reactor in Chalk River. So overall, only a small number of reactors provide moly-99 or technetium to processing plants that basically package into those generators I showed you and ship those to radiopharmacies and hospitals where patients get their scan. Okay? The problem is that these reactors are getting old. And I can say that because only one of these reactors is younger than me. And I think from there, I can truthfully say that when reactors get old, they get expensive to maintain, and they break down a lot, and they become problematic, and the reliability goes down. So overall, I don't want to stress too much the capacity here. This number probably doesn't mean very much, but I think overall, you can see that Canada relatively has a very high production capacity relative to the other reactors, and it is one of the older reactors. And so we at Triumph came together with three other institutions to propose a solution. And I'm just wanting to look at the time here very quickly. I have, okay. So we are proposing a solution to decentralized production. And it turns out that Canada has one of the most advanced cyclotron infrastructures in the world. And the cities that hold cyclotrons that are capable of producing technetium are shown in the green circles here. And the size of the green circles represents more than one machine. So from Vancouver to St. John's, we have machines across the country. And what we're proposing is to produce technetium directly, rather than using a reactor, and we want to use these machines instead. And by having this network of machines, we create a redundant supply, and we also have one that is very close to those radiopharmacies. They're in hospitals already, and these machines are already used to produce other isotopes, so we're essentially wanting to innovate these machines to produce more. In fact, the world's most common isotope, which is a medical isotope, which is technetium-99m. And it turns out that cyclotrons and technetium go way back. I mentioned that Paul Harper and Walter Tucker were the ones that brought it into the generator realm, but it was in fact Ernest Lawrence that, with his cyclotron, basically was actually scooped by just a little bit. Scoop meaning that someone else beat him to publishing the result. But he had his cyclotron and his radiation detectors plugged into the same wall socket. So when he wanted to go in there, he had to turn off his cyclotron and his radiation detectors turned off as well. He didn't realize that his particle accelerator was activating small components inside of his cyclotron. In fact, he was producing technetium, small amounts of technetium, in a molybdenum component that was in that machine. So eventually he came to realize this after someone published the result, and he sent his sample to colleagues, and they in fact validated the fact that he had in fact produced technetium in this machine, so which is one of the first representations of the artificial production of isotopes from a machine like a cyclotron. And today, here's where we're at. From that one cyclotron, we're now at almost 1,000, if not more than 1,000 cyclotrons around the world. And those numbers are now divvied up according to putting on your technetium filters on your glasses, different energy ranges for those machines. And those machines basically operate in that and have certain beam power and whatnot. And it's this column in the middle that actually can produce quite a bit of technetium directly. And I'll explain how in just a minute, but you can see that it's becoming the most popular energy range for cyclotrons, and conveniently, those are the machines that can produce technetium as well. So we assembled our team, team at Triumph, two here in Ontario at the Lawson Health Research Institute and the Center for Product Development and Commercialization at McMaster University, as well as our colleagues at the BC Cancer Agency. So we had a representation of different brands and different types of machines that exist in Canada. And what we did is we developed hardware. This is an attachment that goes on the side of those machines. It holds a target plate that looks like this here in a soda can size target capsule. Those target capsules are loaded into the backside of this target. The beam is delivered through this pipe, and there's a bunch of cooling services and stuff here to keep things in check. And it is this coating, which is molybdenum 100, another stable form of molybdenum that can be, or moly, that can be bombarded with protons to produce technetium directly. And this is a photograph of the world record holder, a cyclotron target that was pulled out of the Triumph TR-30 cyclotron, containing the highest amount of direct produced technetium in the world to date. So we're trying to get this technology now out to Canadian hospitals. We've been tasked by the federal government to do so, and we're well on our way to getting the clinical trial and corresponding regulatory filings for that. So here's a summary of the process we developed. We take molybdenum powder, enriched molybdenum 100, again, stable form of moly. We bake it in a very high temperature oven to create those targets. Those targets are housed in those target capsules. They're irradiated. They're delivered to a shielded workspace where they are dissolved off of the target. Then they're purified. It's hard to see, but there is an automated box here that has valves and syringes and stuff that basically pushes and pulls solutions through there. And you extract sodium pertechnetate, which is the exact same form of technetium that comes from reactor generators. So this process, then you take the excess molybdenum and you recycle it, and you do this process on a daily basis to produce technetium. And numerically, this is the number we use to represent how much activity we've produced on a GE PET trace, which is found here in London and Hamilton, just shy of 5 curies. This is enough for a city of about 1 million people, and the number of people that require technetium in any given day, all the way up to what we produced at Triumph in Vancouver, 32 curies, which would be enough for a population the size of British Columbia, about 4.5 million people. So we, on a daily basis, have proven that we can produce city-size or provincial-size batches of technetium directly. The process is very efficient, and our recycling efficiency is currently quite efficient as well. And we're trying to get all of this into one neat package that we can implement wherever we need to. And right now, I mentioned clinical trials are currently underway, and will be done after we find 60 people to participate. So things are moving along. Collaboration is key, and this team has been recognized by the Governor General, David Johnson. I understand he was here for a while at the University of Waterloo. And so the team represented here have worked wonderfully together, and I owe them a lot of gratitude for their collegial spirit and their collaborative spirit as well. So, okay, I'm going to finish off this presentation with where I think things are going to go from here. So I talked to you about isotope production. I talked to you about reactors and cyclotrons. I talked about how cyclotrons make isotopes, how they can make technetium instead of using reactors. But I believe that in the future that there will be many other uses, and one of them for these isotopes, and one of them is therapeutic. So in the future, I think we'll have examples like this where an individual on the left was imaged. They have advanced metastatic cancer. It's actually non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. It's a lymphoma. It's very spread out throughout their body. And typically when you have advanced metastatic cancer, you're given chemotherapy. And if it's not working, you begin a palliative treatment, which is basically getting ready for the end of life. Now, these isotopes really have tremendous potential. And here's an example of someone that received a treatment with yttrium-90, which is a beta-emitting isotope attached to an antibody. And that antibody was targeted to a specific recognition entity on those tumors. And so basically this antibody brought the yttrium-90 to the tumor site. And after 2 treatments with this, the cancer is almost gone. And so the hope is that if we can tune this technology to use more effective isotopes or more effective antibodies, we can develop this type of treatment for everyone. And so basically what we do is we find an antibody in this blue wedge shape here is a typical representation of an antibody. This pocket here represents a tunable recognition face that this can be used to identify different types of tumors. Specifically, you don't want it to go to healthy tissue. And we can modify those, and this is not size proportionate, but we can modify those with chemical entities to latch on to different isotopes. And I use different examples here. Actinium-225, bismuth-213. There are many, many other options. And so from there, we can develop ways of imaging or treating cancer. So I have one quick video I wanted to show you to explain how this works. So you inject the radio tracer. In this case, it's therapeutic. And the light line only represents where it is rather than what it actually looks like. It goes to the heart, and then the heart pumps it to the lungs as a natural process. It comes back from the lungs, and it distributes throughout the entire body. And it diffuses into the tissue. And because of the antibody that's attached, the idea is that it will clear out of the non-specific tissue like muscle. It will clear out of your excretion organs like the kidney and the liver, and it will hang around in the tumors. And the idea is that the presence of those lethal isotopes, but in very close proximity to these tumors, will eradicate those tumors. So this basically represents the concept that I just described to you on the last two slides. And the hope is that we can develop technologies that will allow this to happen on a routine basis. One can almost imagine a cancer vaccine where you inject this routinely to continually knock down cancer as it develops throughout life. Okay, so from there, I finish up with some description about what Triumph is doing on this front. Triumph currently maintains and operates the world's largest cyclotron. It was an IEEE recognized milestone, along with the BlackBerry, the CN Tower, the first transatlantic transmission and whatnot. So IEEE recognized this. It's 17 meters in diameter. You can see a person standing in the middle of the cyclotron there. It was the one that was built in 1968, beam on in 1974, I believe. And from there, we basically run a number of beam lines which direct those proton beams down to different target stations. Primary function is basic science. It has to be. But there's also the utility of using these beams to produce isotopes. And many of those isotopes I talked about on the previous slide. So we can do more than one thing with this machine. It's a multi-purpose machine that keeps reinventing itself over the years. And one type of technology that we use is to direct that proton beam. This beam line is coming up from here, by the way, to this isotope accelerator. That's what ISAC stands for. It comes up here. It gets directed onto one of two target stations, which then induces spallation or fission, two terms we use to say splitting of uranium or thorium targets. And this is, by the way, natural uranium. This is not uranium-235 or enriched uranium. And the products are then directed and then passed through a bending magnet that separates based on their mass and their charge. And then we collect them. And we can basically study different isotopes that basically collect in a station that looks like this. It's 250 millimeters in diameter. It's a salt disk that the isotopes embed in there, and then you literally put a few drops of water on there, and then you just pull it off as a solution and start to do your chemistry. So this is something we're doing at Triumph to study those new and exciting isotopes. And then, of course, we have more equipment. We go from proton acceleration to electron acceleration through a lab we call the Aerial Lab, or the Advanced Rare Isotope Laboratory. And moving forward, 2019 or beyond, and for many years beyond, we'll be using this to generate a whole new realm of isotopes, and represents a substantial investment from various levels of government in a laboratory like Triumph. So from there, here's an aerial shot of Triumph. The world's largest cyclotron is located in the center of this building here. We have a number of medical cyclotrons. We call them medical cyclotrons because they are dedicated for the production of medical isotopes. And then that isotope separation contraption I just showed you is located in this building. And the ELINAC is split between this building and this new one here. So we have a very concentrated infrastructure of particle accelerators. Triumph is very excited about the applications as well as the basic science that we can accomplish with those accelerators. And we have another one coming online hopefully in the next 2 to 3 years, which is called the TR-24. So we have a huge range of capabilities, and with it a huge portfolio of isotopes that we can use and study along with our collaborators. So with that, I just wanted to say thank you all for your attention today. I think there is safe to say that I believe one day radiation, or radiation from isotopes in particular, will save the planet. I think the Hulk got his beginning by being bathed in the mysterious gamma rays of a thermonuclear explosion. The Fantastic Four were bathed in cosmic rays as they flew their airplane. Spider-Man got bitten by a radioactive spider, and I can't remember what happened to him, but anyways, it started with radiation somewhere. But anyways, with that, I want to thank all of you for your attention today. Thank you. So,
thank you so much. All right, we'll open the floor to questions, and we'll start right here in studio. Please, go ahead.
So you have, say, carbon-11 chemicals injected into someone's body. Are there any concerns when that decays and it's no longer a safe chemical and it's got boron something?
Great question. So if you remember my mole slide, the cute mole, that nanogram of boron, right, is very small. Yeah, it's indistinguishable. Yeah.
I'm going to go to the online audience, but I'm going to give you a choice. Sure. There's an easy question and there's a very perimeter-esque question. Which would you like?
I'm at your mercy. I don't know.
We'll go perimeter-esque. What does Triumph do tied to dark matter and cosmology?
What does Triumph
do? What does Triumph do tied to dark matter and or cosmology?
Okay, I'm not sure I'm the right guy to ask that question to. But you know what? Send me an email and I'll direct you to the right person to answer that question.
Thank you. That's great. And we'll do that.
Yeah, right.
Let's go in studio.
Thanks, Dr. Schaefer. Great talk. I'm Rick DeBow. I'm the chief nuclear medicine at Grand River St.
Nice
Mary's here.
Yeah.
I'm interested in the fact that the NRU will be decommissioned in 2018, and what do you think the timelines are for cyclotron-produced moly or tech by then? And secondly, is there a difference between specific activity you're able to get versus the reactor-produced product?
Okay, excellent question. So our timeline was to coincide with the decommissioning of the NRU, but there's also the consideration that we have to pass through all the regulatory requirements in that process. So we have a new drug submission to submit. The reason for that is a full new drug submission because, ironically, technetium was approved as a medical device back in the 1950s, not as a drug. And so today, they're trying to correct that situation, and we just happen to be the first ones to get there. So we have to do that. Needless to say, Health Canada has a number of mechanisms to accelerate that. We anticipate that we can try to get that new drug submission in early next year, in anticipation that will be done later next year with full market approval, and then from there, it's free to go. Yeah.
So a follow-up question, if I could,
sure.
For me and some of my technologists in the room here, cost is very important. Since the shortage came along with the reactor
right.
breakdowns that you outlined with the 60-plus-year-old reactors,
right.
The global network of supply has strengthened as a result of that. However, so have the costs went up.
Right.
And we suffer with increasing costs currently over the past couple of years, and projected costs are right. are actually quite significant. How do you see the cyclotron technology
right.
coming out at the bottom line in terms of cost compared to the reactor?
Absolutely about the bottom line as well, I agree. And in fact, if I tell you a price right now, a member of my commercialization team will run out of that door and tackle me. So I'm not allowed to say a price, but what I will say is reactors are subsidized because their operations are funded by the federal government. The isotopes are given to commercial entities and sold at a price that represents what we pay today with the appropriate commercial engine in place. What I can tell you is that cyclotron production of technetium on a machine like what you find in Vancouver is at full cost recovery, fully competitive with a subsidized price.
Okay, thank you.
All right.
Very good. I'll go to the Twitter feed and then I'll come back to you. So the Twitter feed asks, was there a different accelerator-based technique for producing TC-99 announced 4 to 5 years ago?
45 years
four
ago.
4 to 5.
4 to 5 years
yeah.
ago. We've been in the news a few times. We have some colleagues in Edmonton and also in Sherbrooke pursuing similar approaches, so that very well may be the fact. I don't know which event in particular that they're talking about, but it's actually very important to notice, and this is a great point, it was on my slide and I forgot to point it out. Cyclotron production of technetium was reported by Lawrence, yes, in the 1920s, 30s, but also in 1970s in Miami. And so I don't want anyone to think that we developed this from scratch. This is a technology that's been known for a while. What has not been demonstrated is that large scale production. That's the key difference, because we're putting 11 kilowatts of power onto that little target space. So you can imagine how hot a 100 watt bulb gets. Can you imagine 11 kilowatts onto that small space? It gets extremely hot. So that's the difference. That's what we've overcome here today. Yeah.
Thank you. And let's go in studio.
Why specifically do you use technetium?
Why do you use technetium?
Specifically.
Yeah, okay, that's a wonderful question. That's a perfect question. Technetium has very ideal radioactive decay properties. So when technetium relaxes from the metastable state to the gram state, if you remember my one slide, it releases a photon that is of an energy that's ideal for escaping from our body and for being lined up in the camera that's trying to detect it. So people immediately saw the benefits of using this isotope that created a very uniform and very perfect energy emission from it.
As a follow-up, I just forgot.
Yeah.
I need to remember it. Can I come back?
Sure.
You can
take all the time you want. Yeah? Please come back. Yeah, that's great.
All right, I'm sure his question was a lot smarter than mine, because I want to ask about the tenderloin. it's sort of pinched off kind of near the top. Why does it have that little dip in it right before?
Pinched off, so.
Yeah, if you could pull up the image, it was kind of near the top right. The tenderloin kind of went thin to thick, and then got narrow, and then got bigger again.
So I'm just going to guess the slide here, shall we? Slide 5. Nope. Let's do, you're talking about.
Two more.
Yeah, right there, right? Yeah, this pinch right here, right? Yeah. It's actually shown a little better right here, right? This pinch?
Yeah.
So this is where you're starting to get beyond the uranium and thorium in the periodic table. Things are becoming entirely radioactive up here. But there's a little island of stability here, and that's a theoretical component that was predicted and proven to be true. But so while it is more stable, it is not technically continued on from this line of stability here. So there is a break, and the stable isotopes, the ones with the half-lives greater than 10 to the 15 years, drop off here, and then you just get that island of stability up there. I think that's the answer to your question. I don't know where you went. Oh, there you are. Yeah. Is that good? Yeah. Okay. Good. Yeah. All right.
Very good. And perhaps the last question, unless he comes back.
So,
go ahead.
Dr. Schaefer, you mentioned, and we caught how the isotopes can actually be delivered by the chemicals to where they're needed. I'm wondering if there's if the reverse ever happens. I mean, you did say the isotopes are chemically similar, but are there any subtle differences that can actually make chemical reactions work better and sort of have isotopes benefit the chemistry?
So I'm not sure if this is the answer to your question, but when you start adding neutrons to a nucleus, you start getting an isotope effect. For something like hydrogen, it's very pronounced, and your reaction rates are much slower or faster depending on the mass. But when you get to the heavier elements, your reaction rate, the difference is minimal. And so you're basically, you have an equivalent, for by and large, you have an equivalent isotope from stable to radioactive, just because the mass difference is very small. Now, if you're talking about the interaction physiologically with a receptor or something like that, there's no difference from the body's perspective. So carbon is carbon and fluorine is fluorine.
Yeah. Thanks.
Great.
Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Paul Schaefer.